Yeah, when I looked again at the short statement I gave to Andreas while he prepared this symposium, I noticed that I was much too optimistic with regard to what I can tell you in 10 minutes about our conference, Careful Risk, Art and Science, Art and the Production of Knowledge, that took place at the Braunschweig University of Art, or HBK, Hochschule für Bildende Künste, exactly 1 week ago. I brought some of the flyers in case someone wants to have a look. With regard to the symposium today, it might be more interesting to look at our conference in the context of its institutional background rather than summarizing the results in a more detailed manner. The Braunschweig University of Art will be celebrating its 50th year as an art academy in 2013. As a form of critical preparation of this event, the philosopher Hannes Böhringer and I have organized the symposium. For us, it was important to give an impulse to stimulate a debate within the HBK about the objectives it's setting itself for the future. The Braunschweig University of Art is an art academy which includes not only study programs in freie Kunst, art mediation, performing arts, industrial and communication design, but also offers purely theoretical study programs such as aesthetics and art history and media studies. It has a full university status, which means you can do your doctorate or also your habilitation there. And so the HBK is an art academy with independent research branches. Artistic practice and research are coexisting here since decades, and expectations from inside and also from outside are high that each field is not only benefiting from this coexistence, but that each field might shape the other's character in a way you will not easily find at other art academies or universities. This aspect is central if you look at the official mission statement of our institution. This should actually be a perfect precondition for an art academy at a time when contemporary art seems to prove itself in a heretofore unknown proximity to contemporary theoretical and scientific discourses. The numerous biennials and other national and international exhibitions over the past 10 or 15 years have been dominated by artistic works that are understood in the context of the term artistic research. For such as the European Artistic Research Network since 2004, or the Society of Artistic Research in Bern since 2010, have become fixtures, new art journals and periodicals are called Art and Research, Journal of Artistic Research or Yearbook of Artistic Research. And scientific conferences take place at regular intervals which address the theme of the relationship between art and the sciences, art and knowledge, or else artistic research. In certain contexts, the term artistic research has become a synonym for timely concept of art. In the US, Great Britain, Scandinavia, and recently also in German-speaking and Eastern European countries, this development has already had an influence on how art study courses are fashioned. Yet within the context of the Braunschweig Academy of Art, this development, together with the political pressure to change study programs with view to the Bologna reform, we've heard about this a lot already today, have been followed by an alienation and a hardening of positions between the artistic and the scientific branches of the university, mainly from the side of the visual arts. By chance, parallel to the Bologna reform, the omnipresent present interest in transgressing the borders between the arts and the sciences is seen as a threat to the specific character of artistic work by some artists. What has sometimes worked well in the past, just on the basis of common interests between artists, scientists, and designers, is now official policy and will have to be fulfilled on a regular basis in a modularized form. And there's always a danger in the institutionalization of such collaborations. So Hannes Böhringer and I were convinced that with regard to this hardening of positions, it is even more important to address the relation of art and science anew and for the moment independently from all institutional politics. The symposium Careful Risk has not approached the relation between art and science and the interest in transgressing the borders between the different realms of knowledge in a strictly systematic or scientific manner. It seemed more interesting to us to invite artists and designers and scientists to talk about their own artistic work next to scholars from the field of philosophy and cultural studies dealing in a theoretical manner with the phenomena of the interest in aspects such as research and knowledge production in contemporary art. We were counting on the power of a free exchange between these fields. Now I will say a little about some of the talks, but you are already, in case there are questions, you can always interrupt. The opening lecture was a lecture, Peril, Risk and Uncertainty, was given by the Italian philosopher Mario Perniola. He dealt with the transformation of the term aesthetic experience with regard to contemporary art, concentrating on the terms relational art and agency art from a philosophical and sociological perspective, relying on Dewey and on the writings of the German writer Ulrich Beck on first and second modernity and on the term Risikogesellschaft. The following day was opened by a lecture of the British artist Tacita Dean on her recent project for the Tate Turbin Hall. Her installation and all that effort that went into this project, I think, is really an impressive example for the extent of research into the aesthetics, the materiality, the aura, and the history of analog 35 millimeter film, or of analog film altogether. Besides her installation, she published a book of hundreds of interviews with actors, filmmakers, writers, philosophers, such as Keanu Reeves, Neil Young, Steven Spielberg, on what it means or meant to them to work with analog film, or about the reception or watching analog film. Which is a documentation of a media at the moment it is threatened to disappear. So next to Tacita Dean, I think you would find a lot of parallels in the way a researcher in media studies or cultural studies would do his or her research. I think the way she talked about it was very obvious. There are a lot of parallel theoretical interests, historical interests, but she also is very interested in the history of the material that was used and in the processes of developing the film and its possibilities. In the actual installation, you I think you can feel all this intensive thought and research. You can feel it in a kind of strength of the work. And also there is a documentation, but it's you know, you can see only moving images and stills, and you would not guess of all the research that went mm-hmm. into it. But I still think I'm convinced that these kind of works, the research is you can experience it in a way through very different channels.
There were then other presentations by artists within the conference,
mm-hmm, yes.
And they were somehow framed as examples of artistic research.
No, I think our politic was rather to invite artists that are commonly not discussed with regard to artistic research, but this was a tactic to win our artists who are to make them open to works that actually use research to a great extent and are still obviously not having a documentary form.
But did that strategy work? What was the sentiment afterwards?
Altogether, I mean, I have to go back and get more feedback, but at least there were even some of the enemies, which is not true. I mean, as I have to say, I have a lot of sympathy for this resistance. It's not that, you know, we want to have the PhD for artists and, you know, all this, it's simply not true. I mean, I think we have to think about ways of developing collaborations or even study programs that have practical and theoretical parts in the way that we think it fits our institution, and that's a long process, and we have to start now to think about the form. But the idea of the conference was to get more people on board, even to think about these things. And the second artist we invited, and I was very impressed by her talk, was Ulrike Korsart. I don't know, she might not be known although she's quite big in Germany, I think. She's used to be a dancer, and she has always been interested in the subject-object relation in a very philosophical way. For example, she made an installation and several other projects on Leibniz and also the relation of objects and space. And she was working for a long time on Leibniz's term of the monade. And she has also been exhibiting at Documenta, I think, Documenta 10 or so. Also she was kind of, she did something like an ethnography, I think, in a way, in her talk. So she was talking about the beginnings and about the processes and all her. So that was really interesting as well, I think.
What was also for me impressive in her talk, she's a teacher at the Art Academy in Dresden, And she has her class in a, you know, rather traditional sense. And with the changing generations of students over a long period, it sounded like a decade or so, really she explores specific themes in terms of memory, in terms of performance, in terms of spatial art. And she spoke about her students and the work that she does with them as though it was a continuous group over this 10-year period, because they were working on the same things, kind of developing and building on top of what had been done before, even though, and she talked about that quite clearly, even though the groups were changing, of course, because there were new students coming in, picking things up, and there was there's a lot of agency in the way in which the students engage with those topics. So even though it's clear that these are her questions and she's guiding that process, but the process is really very much driven by these changing constellations of students. I was very impressed with that, because it also gives a very strong image of what these old traditional models of the art academy can mean, where there's a strong teacher who has an agenda and helps the students to kind of engage with certain topics in a very deep and continuous manner, and also, you know, to experience maybe in your university training that you're actually part of something that is much bigger than this individual practice that you're doing yourself, when you're aware that you're picking up from people and you're handing it over. Yeah.
This is probably a very stupid question, but I'll put it anyway. What is the discussion about differences between preparation for work and research for work? And I mean, for instance, you are based in Lund, and there is a marvelous museum there, which is probably not very original, but it's called Museum of the Sketches. Okay, so you can walk in and you can look at the preparatory work for art pieces.
Mm.
But that is, yeah, I mean, there must be huge discussion about this, but I'm just...
I'm not really an expert, so but with regard to the work that was discussed in the conference, I think you can see, as for example with Ulrike Grossart, it's such a long process, and what you get is sometimes an exhibition or a performance over years, and it's inseparable, I would say, in this case, because the whole artistic work is rather seen as a process, and you know, with some bits taken out that you can show, you know. So, but also then maybe from the perspective of, I should also talk briefly about the lecture by Katrin Peters. She's a professor in media studies. And she used to be at the HBK, and she helped me with preparation of the conference as well, gathering ideas and so on. And she introduced the term Poetologie des Wissens, English
Poetics.
Poetics of knowledge. And this is in Germany, this is an ongoing debate since 10 or 15 years or so, which I find very interesting. This refers to the performative aspect, the aesthetic and or the fictional character of science, as was pointed out, for example, by Josef Vogel and others, but also by historians like of science, like Gaston Bachelard or Ludwig Fleck. And she furthermore argued that it is this performative and at the same time in the political sense a representational character of historische Inszenierung,
historical staging,
in museums or other forms of historical depictions and narrations, which is of interest for contemporary artists like Mark Dion or Peggy Booth, for example. So she was talking about this. I think this is another was another important point of the conference. What are the preconditions for this change in or this interest in the transgression of the borders between fields of knowledge and or sciences and arts? So, and I think this is one could talk about a Foucauldian change of paradigm. And I think the Geschichtswissenschaften is a good example for this new thinking about what science is. So and it's not by chance that a lot of artists got interested in the question of representation of history.
So there is, I'm just coming to think about it. Maybe it has something to do with that. But in economics, as we were speaking about economics yesterday, and so there has been this discussion about the rhetorics and with Deirdre McCloskey, sort of wrote a very successful book about. And economics is simply a matter of rhetoric, so and that was of course met by they ignored it or they were against it. I mean, economists. So exercises in style.
Deirdre McClouds, you said.
McCloskey.
Mm-hmm.
And her big her important book was about rhetorics, and now she's going on. But I mean, and although that was a Keynesian, Keynes, I think, Essays in Argumentation, he wrote something about it, as if it was no secret at all that political economy is a matter of arguing, and arguing is style, and that was a completely different kind of view of economic science than the mainstream economic science.
But I think it comes back to this question, how self-reflexive people accept to be in their own practice. You know, the institutional critique within contemporary art is about a radical and very painful way of critiquing your own position within the art system, and it's also probably a way to distance oneself from something that one has learned to love and hate at the same time. But it's, you know, it is, this practice deals with this engagement, and the poetics of knowledge, you know, the idea of, you know, how is knowledge constructed, how are epistemological systems constructed. This is a question that you can only ask if you accept that your knowledge and the power that you hold and exert through that knowledge is actually relative. It's historically and somehow politically or institutionally constructed. And this is, of course, something that is useful if you want to go there, but it's completely useless or counterproductive if you just want to get your work done.
No.
I mean, I'm being rhetorical here, of course, but I think that there's
think this discovery or this debate really is more and more convinced of the background in the artistic interest in this whole idea of knowledge production.
Mm-hmm.
So.
what is the implication
and representation
of this point of view? What does it imply regarding art and science?
Well, that's a
that's more or less the same thing. That's the more or less the same thing. What is the implication?
No,
yeah, all is poetic or all is constructed.
Mm.
Is that the implication?
No, I don't think so. That's
all kinds, that all kinds of belief systems constructed in different kind, but all are constructed, all are based on fictions. Is that the implication?
No, but maybe one of the implications is that there is a tendency towards the exhibition of the production in a certain way, that like media art is having this tendency anyway. Ausstellung der Herstellung. I mean, this is a tendency. I think that I feel very strongly in this field. I'm following since 15 years that there's a tendency to address these blind spots and to get the machinery out and the display is making the topic.
Sally and Pierre.
Maybe it's part of this wonderful trap that art is about, which is about thinking through doing. Epistemic action, whereby at the same time one is trying to get away from the rhetorical constructs, the archaeologies of knowledge as premises, because, and maybe this accounts for the exhibitionism, if you'll excuse the pun, of arts by definition, because there is this notion of creating sensuous artifacts as objects for shared cultural experience. So it's kind of a there is a kind of a trap in there. Insofar as we want to emphasize the processual, we want to emphasize the hidden part of the iceberg, but we have to show the iceberg. But I like this. I've been quite influenced because I've been working with interface design communities by... I stole thinking through doing from a couple of writers, Klemmer and Hartman, who work on embodied knowledge and iterative processes in interface design. And they use the term epistemic action.
Mm.
And I like it because I think there was a little spar in match yesterday about epistemologies and should epistemological research or the search for epistemological paradigms be what's driving everybody.
Mm.
And I think that this notion of epistemic action, in other words, action as being the spawner and the spinner of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
somehow flips that around.
Yeah.
But of course, you do have epistemic action, as we know, in the scientific experimentation field as well.
Okay.
Two remarks, and it has to do with the discussion you had yesterday with Martin about this installation, where Martin spurs a kind of return of the metaphysical, emergence of metaphysics.
But very much based on this, on the reading of the image as mm-hmm. the main focus of the artistic perception.
It comes up again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What about the epistemic action, the aesthetic action, and the metaphysical idea of truth and the revelation? Because you see, of course, there's a when I think one can see sort of lots of acrobatics, intellectual acrobatics being done now in writing about art to avoid the metaphysical part or the sublime part in the Kantian sense of the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
To keep the first critique only, but sort of to wash out the metaphysics of the third critique. I don't know how you could do that, but that's where the feeling.
Uh-huh.
So then what about the aesthetics if you only go for the epistemics and what about the metaphysics? But I was going to make another remark, and that is when you look at people's practices, for instance when I take Boyce's probably and Michelangelo certainly, you see that they actually, as artistic practices, they work in different modes, in different gears, at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
So Michelangelo is doing his own stuff, he's exhibiting that on floor number 3. He doesn't speak about it at all when he works.
You mean in Pistoletto?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When he works. No. The living Michelangelo.
Sistine Chapel.
So you can, that would be, again, what is the consequence of And if you think that you can actually, in the morning you can work as an artist, in the afternoon you can do seminars, in the night you can write scientific papers, maybe it's possible. Then you could actually, Stieglitz is doing that, economist is doing, getting his Nobel Prize, then he writes fat books about what horrible effects there are of the stuff he did in the morning. And for Europe, they are.
And Satie said, "Prêt à 16h, quoi qu'à 16h15."
No, but also, I mean, the artists, I think all the talks also by this New Zealandish artist Michael Stevens, I think it was, who was really interesting with regard to economics and. And art. He has not only done this project on economics, but lots of others as well. I think they all, they gather, they research in a different way. They follow their, they don't do systematic research, but they follow, here there's this economic source, and then there's a novel of that time, or a poem, or you find an object which is part of the economic process, and you bring all this together in a way that has its own logic, which is not the logic of science.
But this is the quality of emergence that Simondon would talk about individuation and the pre-individual milieu is not specific, but each time that one makes a step within this milieu, one is defining. To come back to the metaphysics question, I was thinking, I don't think it's incompatible with the epistemic action approach if you go to an anthropologist like Victor Turner, who talks about these constructs. He talks about the liminal and the emergence of the cultural construct and the moment of mutual recognition by a cultural community, which he calls communitas. Of course, this comes from Geertz and the other sociologists and anthropologists, but he has this wonderful term, intersubjective illumination.
Can you say it again?
Intersubjective illumination, where he says that a cultural artifact, this is my very probably wrong, abusive interpretation of Turner, but that a cultural artifact emerges at a time or in a situation whereby it achieves a quality of resonance with a community that is exposed to it. And this is, so I think the epistemic action thing is the production through an emergent process of the subject, but then it becomes a magnet and a constituent or a constituting force of the communitas.
But which is very important in Turner is what he calls the betwixt and between
yeah,
stage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this, I mean, the liminal as such is a kind of dynamic ontology. I mean, the instability of the ontology. This is something the main. And this is why this is very often brought over from anthropology to other disciplines, because the liminal as a term is very seductive.
Well, especially performance and performativity.
Yeah, of course, I mean, by the way, the title of the Skin Interfaces show was not Skin Neither Interface, it was the hyphen. In fact, the hyphen was the title.
Of course.
And also maybe one last remark to your question. I also think maybe the artistic production has not changed as dramatically as we think about it when we hear the term artistic research. I mean, I think this is basically what these artists do is what concept art and or institutional critique, aspects that have been around or strategies that have been around for a long time, and they are just at the moment seen through a different perspective because of other changes in the debates, and also idea of the closeness of art and research, I think, also produces a new philosophical interest in the definition, which is still going on, of what is the artistic as opposed to other practices, like philosophers like Badiou, Deleuze, Rancière, and also in Germany, Jana Riebentisch and others. So there's also this movement to differentiate again what separates artistic practice from all other practices.
Well, hardcore scientists, these are all artists.
I know. Yeah, but, hardcore scientists are hardcore scientists. So, you know, they exist also.
Yeah. And the hardcore scientists are only artists also.
So this would have been an aspect that I would have liked to include in the conference, but we didn't manage in the end.
What do you think are going to be the next steps for the academy?
Yeah, there will be. It was planned that there would be an internal meeting of the whole university with several speakers giving statements on their visions of the future of the Hochschule der Künste.
Mm-hmm.
But this, and it was we planned that this was happen would happen 1 week after the conference, but it was postponed now to the 20th of December, and mainly because of the resistance to this whole idea to think about the future of the HBK with regard to the relation of science and art.
I would like to.
I think this might be a little cracked up. I hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to use this as a springboard to go into this discussion about the shape of the institutions. You know, Sarat was also pointing to that when he was mentioning the more informal, clandestine forms of creation and dealing with knowledge. Your nomadic university as something other than the regular institution, because you know my thinking about the arts program here is on the one hand based on what I find as an institutional framework trying to insert or kind of juxtapose artistic practice into it in a manner that is interesting and useful, but at the same time, I think, you know, from my understanding of this whole discussion, we need a perspective for actually changing the institution. This may be a utopian endeavor, because, you know, what we're experiencing is closing down and kind of many structures becoming more static than they were before. But maybe even to kind of define or describe a resistance, formulate a resistance strategy against that, it is, I think, useful to have some sort of a perspective what it is that the institutions might be serving if they were functioning in a better way. So that's something that I would be curious to get some, you know, just general feedback from you on what your utopian idea of an institution would be that, you know, services, shapes. Well, I don't know what institutions kind of do in a general sense. Timon, maybe you would have to help us what the institutions are for and how these institutions cannot get in the way of what people want to do, but that they can actually help to make possible what needs to happen, because that's what they are there for in the first place. Pierre.
And then, of course, most I mean, our generations probably have done projects. We're completely project oriented. And this project, it's getting extra money to do the next thing. But back again to this the professional education, or rethinking business education or art education, whatever. An important thing is in our world, I think, to take into consideration teaching. But teaching, because there is a tendency to you create a project, you get extra funding, you hire people that are not part, or they won't get into the tenure system if you speak like university language, and you try to get away from teaching as much as possible, because teaching has become a kind of drag and you're burdened with it and so on. So I mean, rethinking, trying to understand what teaching could be, and how teaching could what you do could be fed back to teaching, maybe not necessarily through publication, but in teaching, evaluating teaching, that would be my utopia, evaluating teaching in the institution. What is a good teacher, and that means sort of being in touch with students and stuff. So.
Sure.
I was just thinking of Florian Schneider's comparison between the institution and the extitution, where he talks about border economies which allow an increased variety of actors to smoothly switch from the mode of institutions to that of extitutions and back. And I think it's that mobility. He says that the challenge that extitutions face is the question of organizing, while in institutional context, the challenge is unorganizing. I kind of quite like that, because I think that an institution that's worth its salt these days is an institution that's very aware of its differences with an institution, and that they are not necessarily incompatible. They can feed each other. And that if one takes as a core value, as you suggest, teaching, then there is a continuity through a certain kind of... An institution has a perennity that an institution doesn't have. So the continuity that you were talking about earlier, Andreas, in a pedagogical practice, for example, is something that you couldn't implement in an institution. So maybe it's a matter of looking at these specificities.
So you use the term unorganizing?
Yeah, that's from Florian. He's very organized when he writes about things like this.
Ulf.
Yeah. So our projects are mainly integrated in teaching. Not the special project that you see today, that is a special one. But normally it's integrated in teaching. It's important. It doesn't function normally without being integrated in teaching and with the work with students. Yeah? And that is made more difficult, but it's still possible. But regarding teaching in general, it's difficult to measure. It's easy to measure results, outputs, but how to measure teaching? I have read some studies about that, because more than 50% of the variance of evaluations of teaching have nothing to do with the person who teaches. They have to do whether they can choose the seminar deliberately or not, how the room is looking and things like that. That are the sites of ability research on teaching evaluation. So there are many prizes for good teacher, etc. Okay, but from a social science point of view, most of these prizes are given on the basis of artifacts. Yeah? So it's really difficult to measure the good and the bad teacher, because it's also a local phenomenon. Yeah?
Mm.
Researcher can compare over the institutions, but not teaching. Yeah?
Mm.
Really, how can you compare teachers at different universities, etc., etc.? And that is why it is not important when you hire someone, a scientist. Teaching is really no criterion.
Mm.
Insofar you're right, but there are objective problems.
But there's a pendulum swing back to.
Yes, I observed this since 30 years.
It's really slow.
Your headache is only 10 years into this.
What is that?
Sarah?
No, of course the pendulum has been swinging very slowly. And it hasn't quite reached the other end. But we should, I think, observe that though it is important that so much of emphasis is given to research in institutions, we must also look at the effect that the opening of the research dimension has on demoting the importance of teaching, and that the teacher is really absolute rubbish in the university today. The teacher is really just simply putting across the mechanics of modules and bodies of knowledge that have been handed over, and it's really just like the person who's stacking shelves in the supermarket. That essentially is the devoted role of teaching, whereas the promotion of research has led also in many, many ways, if we look at the larger picture in which the institution is functioning in terms of funding, then research too is beginning to show all of those characteristics. I mean, I've now worked with three national exercises on the research assessment, the RAE, and participated in the shaping of the rules for how we assess research at universities in Britain. And all three were deeply troubled by the fact that research is also simply a matter of going through the motions of what looks like research, and that the best research is not necessarily the one that is accredited, but the best research is the one that meets the criteria that will gain the largest or highest number of points so that your department is going to be well funded. So that area of research has also deeply distorted our notions of what research actually amounts to. So there are these two real problematic conditions that we have to face in the context of what is happening to the institution. This is why I use the word factory to describe them. And unless we face up to these distortions that have taken place, we won't know how to get teaching back into focus in order to create the intense learning experience that we valued from the old masterclasses and the MAs, especially in Germany, the long duration of the contact with the person you came to study with, all those ideas that we began to think of as being old-fashioned, the notion of devotion in a way, which rose up with the Ulf Linde exhibition in Stockholm at the Moderna Museet. There is an artist who devoted his whole life to recreating and making replicas of Marcel Duchamp's work. It is a form of research, it is a form of knowing, it is an epistemic approach to Duchamp, but knowing it from under the skin of Duchamp's thinking, by making and remaking. It seems an absolutely crazy thing to do, but it is one now, as we observe him in his 80s, it is a most astounding body of knowledge that has been produced. It would not count as research, it would not count as good teaching anymore, because you know it demands a devotional approach to a body of work and a kind of thinking. So I feel that until we really are prepared to examine what's happened to research, what's happened to teaching, we will not be able to clear the space again for the larger institutions to become genuinely creative places. They will be creative in patches, of course, but the general logic is towards churning out products.
Sally, you were first.
Sorry, yeah. Of course, you're right, Sarat. And at the same time, I would want to nuance, because I think that global statement doesn't do justice to what is also a swinging back. which I've witnessed, even, you know, coming to England 7 years ago. Newcastle is a place that's contrary to London in a demographic part of the country that is socioeconomically completely underprivileged and appallingly serviced. There was and is, within a Russell Group university, an extremely strong emphasis on conjoined teaching and research, and the fact that good research had to inform good teaching. So I think that out of London and the Oxbridge circle, there have been some very interesting models, and I think that places like Sussex, I'm not going to defend my current institution because I'm too mobile for that to be credible, but I think there is a definite move towards a revaluing of conjoined teaching of research practices. It's not necessarily global either, and perhaps excellence has always been patchy. If there were any such thing as something that was integrally excellent, everybody would know about it and nobody would be anywhere else. You know, it's like if all the idiots were in one place, everybody would avoid it. So I think there is a swing, and I think perversely, I'm not looking forward to it at all, the fee rise, but perversely, this disgusting attitude of the towards the student as client and consumer of the factory product means also that there was great nervousness about national student surveys, quality of teaching. And I mean, I love teaching. I have a fantastic time with my students. I just had no idea, because I feel so naive about it, that behind my back they were actually being scrutinized and queried about the quality of their classes. For one thing, I didn't know about it, and if I had, I probably wouldn't have given a damn anyway. But somebody got back to me a couple of weeks ago and said, oh, they really like your classes. What? But there is there's a flip side to them being a paying clientele. And I think that if we're smart and if we value teaching, then we can be instrumentalising that swing to our own ends, which is to revalue teaching.
I think that argument has been there for many years.
Yeah.
I think the idea that the consumer does come as a litigant into the university, and the possibility of potential litigation against the university has, of course, been a deep corrective in many ways. So that seems to me to be simply a kind of correctional attitude to how the university might function with people who pay a very high fee, because they expect a commodity, they want certain standards, they will put exercise pressure on the institution to deliver. That hasn't exactly happened. I appreciate what you're saying, but that hasn't exactly happened in the Russell Group, let's say, the most elite group in London. It hasn't.
Well, certainly not in London.
Because the elite universities have the highest international student population who pay, get what they want, are certified, and leave.
Yeah.
They've gone to jobs in the United Nations or IMF or whatever. So they're not hanging around really to see whether the institution is functioning as a genuine site for knowledge creation and so on. They're essentially passing through a system.
Sure.
I have experience of Northumbria University, Sunderland University, Birmingham, where I have done assessments of what's going on. I've overseen the construction of programs of study and so on. I do think these universities are in a very vulnerable position as money situation changes.
Mm-hmm.
They will in fact face shutdown.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we will move away from the old hierarchy of the universities to a smaller hierarchy, with the universities that charge the highest fee.
Mm.
In fact, the most alternative university that's emerged out of the debates in England is going to charge the highest fee.
Yeah,
£54,000
for
the degree, say.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's
fully
booked.
It's
fully
booked.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people ready. There's no problem in selling
that
degree in London. And it's part of our university's constitution that we should allow such a degree to be set up. So this is why I don't see that.
No, I'm not defending the situation. I'm not defending this litigationist student as consumer ethos. I hate it. But what I'm trying to look for, as somebody who's engaged in a university, as a kamikaze, non-tenured idiot, in the idiosyncratic sense, is a way that I can use the sorts of criteria and key performance indicators that the hierarchy and the national governance bodies are wielding to my own ends and say, students need quality teaching. So, you know, it's tactics, it's strategy.
And quality teaching, I think, as Ulf was mentioning, when you look at the form, which tries to check out what is quality teaching, it really has little to do with what the teacher is actually doing.
Yeah, but you can, if you're smart, you can swing that within your institution, in the UK, anyway.
Yeah, but you know, I think one has to understand how systems just simply go into autopilot and chug away. And so teaching quality assurance, research, assessment for excellence, all of these just chug away with the rules that have been set down. But what's actually happening in terms of the experience of thinking that one offers in these institutions, that to evaluate that is the hard thing today. Of course there are devoted teachers. I'm just amazed in England especially there is such devotion of teachers to teaching, and that teachers under very difficult circumstances actually function as teachers, administrators, and as researchers, and as people who are constantly publishing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing that they haven't cracked up completely and gone screaming out of these institutions. So that shows a degree of their commitment to the activity of teaching and the process of learning. But I do feel for us to move forward to bring the clandestine projects that I speak of as the self-raising, self-raising moments, to bring them into some sort of alignment with the monolithic weight of the institutions. That's the problem. How do we create that bridge?
That's the question.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Yes, we can.
Try
harder.
Why were you not talking about perturbation anymore today? I think we need some perturbation. Yeah.
Yeah. We are perturbed.
I thought we were all perturbed.
Yes. Yes.
I think maybe that's a good notes to end on, you know. How do you do it, and we're all perturbed.